Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
Herzlich willkommen zum Elbphilharmonie Talk. Am Mikrofon ist Tom R. Schulz. Ich habe heute gesprochen mit Max Richter, dem britischen Komponisten und Pianisten, der den Reflektor Max Richter und Julia Maar hier in den kommenden Tagen in der Elbphilharmonie gestaltet. Und wir haben uns eben unterhalten und wir haben nur Englisch gesprochen. Ich hoffe, das ist okay, weil wir viel zu bereden hatten. Wir haben uns unterhalten über Adorno und über Luciano Berio und über seine musikalische Philosophie und über Klänge und über das natürliche Gärtnern und über Traktoren und über eine Menge ziemlich lustiger und interessanter und schöner Dinge und natürlich hauptsächlich über die Musik, die in den kommenden Tagen hier gespielt werden wird. Viel Freude beim Zuhören wünsche ich.
So Max, funny enough, but we met once.
Did we?
You won't remember, and it's, I think it was in 2015 or even earlier, and it was in the Grünspan, I think, in Hamburg. There was this beautiful old rock and roll club.
Oh yes.
And they did this yellow lounge thing.
Yep.
With one of your pieces being performed.
It was recomposed.
I think it was recomposed. Yeah. It must have been 2013, I said, probably.
Right.
And we were standing on the balcony, musing the still empty hall at that point. And we introduced each other. It was very nice. And I remember making you compliments on 24 postcards.
Oh, yeah.
That I liked these pieces so much.
Right.
And we spoke and you told me, you know, back then I couldn't compose any longer pieces because the kids were so small. And I never had enough time to really sit down and work on music. And so that was, I mean, that came out in 2008, right, these postcards. There's quite some miles to go from there to sleep with 8.5 hours.
Yes.
What happened in between, besides kids growing up?
The kids growing up. Well, the kids grew up. I mean, I'm interested in the formal properties, the sort of physical properties of a piece of music relating to the subject matter. I think that, for me, that makes sense, a sort of architectural relationship between what I'm trying to say and the shape of the actual piece.
And the shape would include the duration, the length.
The shape includes the duration, yeah. So in the case of sleep, you know, it has a functional aspect, a utility aspect in a way. It's a tool. But it's also a poetic object. And actually both of those qualities, to me, suggested extended duration. You know, it's a tool for people to find rest. So it needs duration. And also, from a poetic standpoint, it's an invitation to, you know, switch off and reflect on the big questions. And there's something about a piece of music that feels like it's bigger than you.
Like a blanket?
Like a blanket, right? It's a sort of, it's a place to kind of hide away, in a way, right?
Disappear
so,
in the music.
So that for both of those reasons, that piece had to be big.
You know, one person whose name you certainly are familiar with, Arnold Schönberg, he had this... No, it wasn't a Schönberg, it was Theodor Adorno even.
Right.
Adorno, he spoke of the ideal listener, you know, the listener who would be able to structurally detect the content and the buildings, the architecture you're talking about of music.
Yes.
Who would be the ideal listener for sleep? Wouldn't that be a sleeping person simply?
Yes, well, sleep is a piece, in a sense, which doesn't have... a prescribed listener in mind. In a way, it's the opposite of Adorno's idea. Not for the first time, I'm on the opposite side of Adorno.
I reckon.
So actually, sleep invites a kind of a participation, which is open. So people can find their own relationship to the work. And actually, sleep can be listened to, but it can also simply be experienced, inhabited, you might say, like a landscape.
Yeah. What feedback do you get from listeners? I guess they will write you and say, Max, last night was fabulous.
Yeah.
My sleep.
Well, I think the thing about sleep is because it, in a way, blocks out all the noise of our daily lives, and invites a kind of a singular concentration, a singular experience. I think what happens is that the kind of bigger questions of our lives sort of surface when all the noise is switched off, you know. The basic reasons why we do anything, you know, those questions we all deal with all the time, mm-hmm. they sort of bubble up. So people have expressed that a lot, you know, questions of meaning, questions of mortality, time passing, you know, philosophical, speculative stuff.
Which is quite a meta level for music. I mean, music sure. oftentimes, of course, evokes mm. these kinds of questions mm-hmm. as it's so immaterial.
Right. So, I mean, this is the extraordinary thing about music, isn't it?
Yeah.
It really has an effect on us. I mean, measurably and emotionally and physiologically, psychologically, in every way, intellectually. And yet, you know, even those of us who spend our lifetimes working with this thing, we sort of don't understand it. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like physicists and quantum mechanics, you know. I think it was remarked recently with by Carlo Rovelli, where he says, well, we use quantum mechanics all day long, every day in our computers, but basically no one understands how it works. Yeah. And I feel a bit like that with music. You know, it has a sort of a magical power, which is, yes, we can understand it to a certain extent, but the way it really does what it does, and that's a
remains a mystery.
It's a beautiful right? secret.
Yeah. Max, when we were in the recital hall and I was telling you this little joke about it, with this little description of the woman who says, you know, the wall looks like nut chocolate, mm-hmm. you said Rittersport, and you said it like so instantly and so without the slightest accent that I just have to ask you, could we just converse as well in German?
Well, I'll tell you why I was able to say Rittersport so perfectly, and that is because my German is the German of a child.
Absolutely.
And of course, Rittersport is a very important vocabulary word in the world
of the 60s and 70s and every time. Yeah.
But if we're trying to speak about Adorno, then I'm going to have a problem in German.
Okay.
Because that wasn't my sort of four-year-old reading.
But that means like you went away from Germany when you were four. That means 1970, right?
Yeah.
So about that time.
Around about that time, yeah.
Why were you in Hamm in the first place? I mean, your parents were living there?
My parents are German. I was born in Hamm. Yes, that's where the family was from. My father's job moved to the UK, so we moved to the UK. And my education, my musical education, cultural education is in the UK. In the UK. So that's my sort of, you know, musical Weltanschauung.
Yeah.
We lived in Berlin later on. We lived 8 years in Berlin.
How old were you then?
We went back to the UK about 6 years ago.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's quite recently.
You as an adult
yes,
person?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Mm.
So, yeah. So I've lived in a lot of different places, but basically my sort of orientation point is, I was going to say British. It's not really British. It's European. You know, I don't really like the idea of British. At all.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Because
I was wondering how much of your German heritage, if you say your family comes from Hamm and maybe even grandparents, you would go back and forth on a regular basis.
Yes.
So how did that inform your thinking, your approach to music?
I mean, music is a, you know, it's a borderless, which is one of the beautiful things about it, I think. Although, of course, you know, the main corpus of classical music historically is centered on sort of Austro-Germany, middle Europe, right? So I was very aware of that. I think every musician is. British music has its own touchstones, which I really love. For example, the Elizabethan Renaissance, you know, that contrapuntal music from that period is an extraordinary, quite Anglo thing.
Mm-hmm.
The music of Purcell, you know, I mean, extraordinarily wonderful.
Absolutely, yeah.
And there are other sort of moments in British musical history which I love. I sort of feel like, I think as an artist, you sort of invent your own little country, you know, of cultural references. Mine is a sort of a hybrid world, I guess.
One thing I always find intriguing in the British music is the predominant role of singing.
Yes.
All these boys' choirs.
Yeah.
And I think even the high standard of beat music in the 60s was due to this factor.
That's close harmony.
Yeah, close harmony singing, the bluntness and the courage to sing in the first place.
Yeah, right.
While it's in Germany, we are totally, you know, our song was so compromised during the Nazi years
that
nobody kind of, you know, the our sort of folk songs...
co-opting of the folk songs into the National Socialism.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I think in the UK, that choral tradition actually does go back to the Elizabethans.
Mm-hmm. I think so too.
Part singing, voice singing, I mean, absolutely is part of it. And it goes through from, you know, into the 18th century and then, you know, obviously Handel, adopted Brit. and then, you know, Stanford, Parry, Elgar, this is... You know, British choral singing. I mean, it's...
Benjamin Britten. Even.
Yeah, I mean, Benjamin Britten, exactly. It goes all the way through. So it's all in those, actually, in the choir schools, you know, in the universities, there's little choir schools. And, you know, I mean, it's just, it's part of it, part of the
texture. It's a grand tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So coming back to your musical upbringing, I guess, of course, must have been piano lessons somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And did you love those?
I had a sort of a mixed trajectory with the piano, really. I mean, I always wanted to play the piano, and I had my first lessons when I was really quite small.
Still, you know, in Harman?
No, UK, but only just.
Okay.
Sort of five, sort of thing, something like that. But I had a sort of rather well-meaning but quite brutal old lady, sort of old school, used to hit me if I played the wrong note.
On the fingers?
On the fingers. So I was really sort of... I'm not doing this, you know. So it took me a little while. I sort of took a holiday from the piano for a few years, and then I got into it in my teen years more seriously. The piano is my instrument. It's my sketch pad. It's, you know, it's everything.
The revolving
the 360.
Point. Yeah, totally. Mm. And then I think it has also much to do with the organ in some ways. I do associate your music to this solemn kind of organ, you know, slow tempo.
Right.
And of course, the strings.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I think the organ, it's interesting. I mean, the organ for me is, in a sense, more about, well, of course, it's about the sound, but it's also about that kind of numinous acoustic space and fingerprint it brings with it. You know, if you hear an organ tone, it sort of opens a door in your mind immediately about all of that, you know, historical literature.
Yeah.
The idea of this building in that, you know, the instrument in the building and what that signifies and this sort of, all of those sort of meanings come with it.
Smells.
Yeah. They all come with it. So that's great. It's a great way to sort of evoke a particular feeling of place, atmosphere, intention.
And there is a tenderness that you choose when you use the organ, I find.
That's right. I mean, I like the organ not for its kind of blood and fire noises.
Yeah.
I like it for it, the intimacy, the quietness, and this sort of purity, particularly of the flute stops, you know, these sort of very
wooden,
plain, woody colors. Very beautiful. Yeah.
And of course, also, again, it's about the duration, I think, the length.
Yeah.
You know, kind of playing with time in a way the time kind of dissipates.
Yes.
In the perception of the listener.
Right. Well, I think that's something that music does very beautifully. You know, a piece of music is in a way like a time machine. You know, it can make time flow at a different rate. You can also feel that you are transported by a piece of music, either temporally or really in terms of place. You know, a piece of music can also convey a sense of place.
Totally.
I remember Hilary Hahn saying this to me when we were working years ago on Mercy, and she was saying, you know, this piece, it feels like a particular place. And I was interested to hear that from her. You know, she was saying, you know, one of the things I'm trying to do when I'm making an interpretation is to figure out what the place feels like, where this piece is, you know? Her sort of research into a piece is discovering the territory that it sort of inhabits. I really thought that was interesting.
It's a very three-dimensional world connecting to sound.
Yeah, I mean, she is an extraordinary thinker as well as an amazing player. You know, I mean, incredible player. But she's also a huge mind.
Very clear, sharp mind. Mm-hmm. And good German, by the way, also. She's pretty accurate.
Mm-hmm.
We have this wonderful reflector of yours coming here. And I wonder, you could have chosen to say, I want my music to be represented as much as possible in this context. And of course, some of your major pieces is represented here, but then you chose sometimes pretty apocryphal composers and interpreters who are fairly unknown here. What made you choose these artists?
Yes. I mean, the first thing is, I guess, that the choice is not only mine. I mean, this is a collaborative program with which I made with Julia, my partner.
Who and unfortunately couldn't travel with you, otherwise we would have sitting here
three of us. Yeah. So, so really this is about our enthusiasms. And if there is a common thread to our enthusiasms, we are all, I think, as both my work and Julia's work demonstrates, we're very interested in boundaries, in sort of borders between languages, borders between genre, borders between traditions. So I think the artists who we've chosen, generally speaking, are people who are asking questions about the medium, about the language they're working in. You know, so you have someone, well, I could mention any of them really, but say someone like Jay Lynn, who's a sort of a laptop, you know, producer, but her work feels very, well, it just it doesn't feel like it's made in that way. You know, it has a sort of a completely different, a unique sort of texture. And you know, many of the other, Christy McBride, Jason Moran, you know, it's jazz, but, you know, it's kind of different. Or the program that Acme are playing, you know, all of Julius Eastman actually personifies this in a way.
Yeah.
You know, he's someone who's sort of asking questions about the medium. And he's sort of almost like, I almost see him as a sort of outsider artist. You know, in visual art tradition, you have this outsider category.
In many ways.
You know, we don't really have this in contemporary music, this outsider category, you know, that, but although there always have been such people, you know, like Moondog or, you know, whoever. So, yeah, people who are sort of, by their work, in a sense, commenting on the language itself.
I like how you use the word language. I like how you use the word boundary. Mm. And also, there was one other expression that just slipped my mind, where I would like you to elaborate a little more on, because boundaries are there to be transcended and to be very aware of. What was more important for you?
Well, I mean, in my own work, I mean, thinking about my sort of trajectory, you know, it starts in with a very straightforward classical music composer's training. You know, university, conservatoire, Berlioz, all of that, you know. So I was all set to be a kind of, you know, sort of late modernist sort of composer, you know. Mm-hmm. And I started that way. You know, I started writing this music, which was, you know, an extraordinary number of notes.
Serial stuff, 12-tone stuff, electronic music.
Sort of total serial / kind of set theory, logic, la 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 la, all that linguistic stuff.
Brainy.
Which was happening in the super brainy, you know, super brainy. And that was my, you know, so it was kind of orthodox music in a way, right? But I always had this other thing going on. You know, I had this interest in electronic music, in post-rock, in sort of free improvised music, all these things, minimalism. So really what I've done is I've incorporated what you might call these kind of other musics into this kind of spine of written down music. So I've incorporated the idea of the score as the text. So that's still classical, if you like. But then the studio and the electronics, the computer, all these other things also found a place, a kind of a natural home in what I was doing. And I've just felt like I was sort of taking colors from a palette and just putting together a very specific palette that would become my way of talking.
Your language.
My language. Mm-hmm. My way of conveying what I wanted to say or the questions I wanted to ask. And I think that's... that to me seems very natural, but it is in a way, yes, unorthodox.
And that's a development that took a number of years, I guess.
I mean,
when did you meet Berlioz? That was at the ending of your
postgrad, after the academy, so around 1989,
late
kind of time, end of the
80s.
Yes, and this was in a way, there was another thing that was happening around that time, which was that the American minimalists were becoming really, you know, very well known. And also the music from the Baltics was coming. Oh. So Arvo Pärt, all of those other guys, you know, like, well, Sisask, in fact, who were playing this week. And Erkki Sventtur and all these guys, you know. So this was, in a way, an invitation to examine the fundamentals of what I'm doing, you know. And Berio was quite instrumental in that, you know, because in a sense, the music I brought to him was a sort of, you know, each piece was a kind of a thesis on X, you know, some musical, obscure musical problem, which I'm solving in this piece, you know, that sort of was the dynamic in those days.
Yeah, and you yourself weren't too pleased with it.
Well, no, I just felt like, well, you know, there was this, always this feeling that you set yourself this Herculean task of calculation, and then you maybe succeed in this Herculean task of calculation, and you've got this very complex score, and you can justify every note because it's the, you know, retrograde inversion of some set theoretical problem, you know. But that isn't the same thing as having as really talking. And a piece of music like a piece of Thomas Tallis really speaks to you in a very direct, simple way. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean the music is simple. It doesn't mean the music is dumb, but it speaks to you very simply.
And it doesn't and make the detour through your brain. And
it has a sort of a directness. And that, to me, is something that Arvo Pärt's music had. You know, this idea of, again, his music feels simple and direct. It actually isn't. There's a lot more going on under the hood than you might think. And that's why it's good. And that's why it kind of stands up beyond its kind of rather reduced surface.
And he's a true master because he keeps being totally unpredictable.
Completely.
I mean, whatever he does is totally original.
Yeah.
And
it could sort of only be him, which is great, right? I mean, this is a wonderful thing. So really this idea, and Berio actually sort of catalyzed this for me. He said, look, what are you actually trying to do? You know, you've proved you're very clever. What are you actually trying to do? And I thought, well, you know, this thing, music, is about talking. It's a way to talk to people. It's a way to tell a story. It's a way to ask a question. And if you're trying to do those things, then you have to convey that in a way that is comprehensible, you know. That's it.
That must have been coming both as a shock and as a relief in a way.
In a way, yes. I mean, for me, you know, being able to return to a kind of a tonal world, it was a great relief, you know. Yes, absolutely. And I felt sort of, you know, that from a sort of my previous standpoint would have been utterly heretical. And sort of wrong, Adorno, you know, just totally. Wrong, yeah. Incorrect.
Yeah.
So it was a sort of a, like a light bulb. And then I started to work in this sort of new language, just trying to find a very specific personal way to do that. And then that, I guess the first project that really does that is Memory House, which is written sort of 2000, 2002, that sort of time.
That's the Virginia Woolf thing?
No, that's Three Worlds. Now, Memory House is actually not a project which is well known.
Okay.
Because when we first released it was released by the BBC on a record label that they had on Lake Junction, which is their kind of everything music show.
Okay.
So I managed to record this thing, which is an orchestral piece, quite big. It's 75 minutes. And then they sort of shut the label down and deleted the record immediately. And we couldn't play it.
And it never resurfaced again. Did you rebuy the rights for
did
it?
It did resurface because 10 years later, we managed to premiere it at the Barbican. And so it became this sort of legendary lost record in a way.
Interesting.
Very frustrating, but, you know. And then we managed to release it later on, I think 2008. And since then it's sort of been around. So,
okay. Yeah. But it's an earlier work, or like a pivotal moment in your development.
It's like a lot of sort of first projects. It's very multidimensional, and it's a kind of series of experiments.
Mm-hmm.
to see what sorts of things this language could do. And I mean, in a way, everything I do is, it has that quality. You know, it's a sort of experimental, yes, a series of, you know, what ifs.
Yeah. What I like about the music is also that the language then itself is so musical that it can bear actual spoken language without being tautologic, you know, just doubling something.
Yeah.
And this must be something that has always been of interest for you, because you've been working with very different texts, I find.
Yes.
Murakami and Virginia Woolf and poetry. And these, how do these two streams come together in your mind when you work?
Well, I love, I mean, you know, I'm
Kafka.
A reader, you know, I love reading, and literature and poetry especially has been my sort of lifelong sort of other passion, you know.
Do you like poetry yourself?
No.
This is not your language.
That is not me. My daughter is a poet, but not me.
Nice.
I mean, I love, you know, stories. I love literature. For me, one of the things that's wonderful about creativity is this encountering of another mind. And literature, obviously, is a very, you know, a very powerful way to do that. And so, in a way, I've always used texts as a way to sort of clarify something, you know. So in the Blue Notebooks, you know, the Kafka is mostly, his subject is really doubt. You know, that's what he's about. And that time where the Iraq invasion was being justified falsely, as we now know, you know, this was a time of doubt. So Kafka was perfect for that, you know. And
so, did you run into Kafka at that time, or were you deliberately choosing for something that would?
Oh no, I
be
chose
an equivalent for you.
Yeah,
own
no, like a lot of people, I read Kafka in my sort of gloomy teen years. You know, he's perfect for that, right?
Absolutely.
And then I just thought, okay, this little collection, the Notebooks, this could be a jumping off point for this story I want to tell with this record.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you have had these other encounters, Virginia Woolf, Murakami. Mm. I'm totally intrigued. I have to admit, I haven't heard it yet, but you have Robert Wyatt reading some
Murakami, yeah.
Mm. And I mean, I love Robert Wyatt. Are you still in touch with him? Do you know what he does?
I haven't seen him for a long time. No, Robert is, I mean, he's
one of the heroes, isn't he?
Yeah, he's great. He's absolutely brilliant. And he's had so many brilliant lives, you know, first of all as a drummer, obviously, but then all of his solo work and
songs.
I mean, he's just extraordinary, you know. He's an extraordinary person and really an artist in every sense, you know. And I, you know, when I came to do Songs from Before, I saw the record as quite autumnal, you know, and the Murakami texts are very sort of reflective. They're very evocative. And, you know, I love the way in Murakami's world, you know, facts and dreams are kind of the same.
Inseparable.
Exactly. And I just thought Robert would be a great sound, you know, because his voice is very particular. So, yeah, I just asked him and he said yes. So,
did you go to his place to
record? Yeah, I went to his place and just recorded it on a little, you know.
So, you know, the view we all only know from record covers.
Right,
you know,
exactly, yeah.
Overlooking the sea or something?
Well, actually, it was in a different house then.
Oh,
but,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm. But then you didn't follow up on this one, working with him on other projects?
No. No, I tend to sort of quite like to explore new things, you know, try something new each time. I mean, that's one of the pleasures really of creative work is to go places you haven't been.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm sort of always trying to think about what's next. Yeah.
But oftentimes going with the same people, like ACME, you've been working with them for, I don't know, 2 decades or so.
ACME, I mean, they're just fantastic. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they're just such wonderful players, wonderful collaborators. They're really passionate about the music and they, you know, they're just, the commitment is wonderful. And they're just, you know, spectacular.
They are in the house. They are rehearsing, I guess, for the big
we have sleep coming
thing
up.
The big sleep, the Raymond Chandler big sleep.
It is the big sleep. Yeah.
How do you deal with inevitable mistakes during any performance with them?
You just...
Well, it happens, you know. I mean, every performance is a laboratory. You know, we're making that real-time experiment, that real-time journey through the material. And there are always events, you know, happenings with an audience. An audience can be different. You play differently. It's a sort of, you know, it's a dynamic relationship.
But this time we don't have any audience. No, we just exactly. have the camera.
So. Yeah, for us, you know, we will play that piece, you know, like our lives depended on it, as we always do.
No matter of whether people lying on the floor and snoring.
No, not at all.
Did you have that sometimes, people snoring heavily when you're performing?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. There's something, in a way, you'd think it would disturb you, but in a way, it's sort of quite comforting, this snoring sound, you know, because you feel it's like a cat purring, you know?
Okay.
And you just think, well, we must be doing something right here, you know?
That's what I think. I mean, you feel like justified.
It's a validation.
You did it right. But then, I mean, having people giving so much noise can also be annoying, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, we have had some, we did have in New York one time, somebody snoring in the front row who was louder than the PA. Wow. And was actually coming back into the microphones because he was so loud. So we actually, somebody just
gently
turned him
over and said, come on.
Yeah,
that's great. Let's go back again for a minute to the artist. He said, righteously, of course, that you chose these musicians together with Julia.
Mm-hmm.
Who is listening more of music coming from the outside, from the two of you? Is it her or is it you? Or are you just sharing? Because sometimes I know composers, they don't give much to music from other people in the first place. So they just, you know, I have enough to do with my own stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think we both listen pretty widely a lot of the time. I mean, the only problem with being a composer is you can't listen to music while you're composing, basically. So obviously, you know, my listening hours are probably less. But, you know, my listening time is sort of when I'm cooking, mostly. And Julia, of course, being like many visual artists, has music on basically all the time, you know, one way and another. So, but we share ideas and we share enthusiasms. And,
so if she has discovered something new, she comes to the kitchen and says, Max, listen to this. I just found so-and-so. What do you think?
Yeah, sure, of course. Absolutely. Yeah.
Mm. And that was how you... piece by piece brought this program together?
Yeah,
also?
It's very conversational. You know, all our... I mean, our work is, in a sense, two separate bodies of work, you know, running in parallel. And there are some works which are really collaborative, you know, like Voices, like Sleep. You know, there is a sort of huge fingerprint of Julia in those works. And other... you know, this festival is like that. You know, it's all... our collaboration is really... you know, the kitchen table, you know, we sort of sitting around chatting, having ideas.
Can you elaborate a little more about the actual cooperation in the musical terms? I mean, would she come to the piano and suggest other notes, or would she say,
no,
this is beautiful, let's go more in this direction rather than in that one?
Julia isn't a musician.
Yeah.
And she wouldn't ever claim to sort of have a direct impact on what the music is.
Yeah.
But neither would I on the, you know, I wouldn't say, you know, make that edit there or, you know, that different color, you know. It's not really like that.
But still, you can somehow smell whether she likes something
Exactly. It is a sort of 360 collaborative life partnership. So there's no sense in which Julia isn't involved, but it isn't, you know, it's not a direct sort of active involvement. Hard to describe it.
Yeah. And it's hard to imagine. I mean, being a married man and knowing how, you know, sometimes conflicts can arise and then having all this also in the artistic work.
Yeah.
Are there moments where you just want to shut the door and say, Julia, come back tomorrow? We've just
not
argued.
Really, no.
Not really.
We do get on very well. And actually, you know, our creative conversations and our sort of life, they are seamless. You know, it's a very sort of, there isn't one moment when we're sort of not dealing with the creative. You know, it's all very kind of fuzzy, we would say in the UK.
Okay, which also enabled you to put the studio in your living area.
In a sense, yeah. I mean, what we've done is we've divided up this old farm shed. It's one of these big metal industrial sheds, which used to be full of tractors. And we've turned it into a collection of studios. And also a part of it is our house. So Yulia has her studios at the front, and there are various other spaces, and then some recording rooms and my writing room. And in this wood. So it's a kind of, in a way, a sort of idyll.
East end of Cotswolds, so...
Yeah, it's sort of half an hour outside Oxford kind of thing, yeah. Yeah.
So it's not the posh part of Cotswolds, it's more the rural...
Downtown.
Downtown Cotswolds.
Downtown Cotswolds.
That's funny. Can you tell me a bit about the installation that Julia is going to present in the Kai Studios? Because that's obviously... Yeah. Shot in on the premises in,
yes,
in
right.
your studios. What's to expect from people who are going to watch this?
Sure. Well, I mean, obviously, unfortunately, she can't speak about this, but I can give you a little sense as it were a spectator. So this is a three screen film with four channel sound, and it's called Studio Diary, and it is a kind of a document of just what's happening in the building during a week.
And that doesn't mean taking the tractors out of the the huge thing. It's some creative
You know, during that week we had stuff going on in the building in terms of, you know, recordings, bits and pieces of like people playing, rehearsing, things happening in their sort of art studio in her space, things happening in the woods. Mm-hmm. And things happening in the garden, because the whole building is fed from this. We have a kind of a little mini farm which grows all the food that feeds the orchestra.
Oh, cool.
So it's the building is very 360. So all of those things are kind of in this film. So it's a kind of a document portrait film.
Very interesting. Very beautiful. Is like a self-sustained little unit.
Thing is a kind of, it's a sort of utopia.
Yeah, it sounds like that. So you have a couple of people who work in the farming and gardening.
Yeah, the
and
idea is that,
and...
yeah, absolutely. So the building is carbon positive because there's a huge roof, so it's solar. So we can run everything, including the cars and everything, off the roof.
Wow.
And we feed the whole place from the garden.
So, all year long?
So far. We shall
okay,
see.
That was still easy because it was just summer.
Exactly.
And stuff,
we'll see. We'll see. Yeah. We'll see how many turnips we can eat over the winter.
And these three screens show three different things all the time?
Yeah,
or do they blend into each other?
Yes, it's very... I mean, it's very creative. It's quite non-linear. You know, it's an impressionistic, poetic film.
And the entire piece has a length of...
It's about 18 minutes, I think.
And that's being looped and...
Yeah, yeah. I think it's really beautiful. And the other element that is in there is... a visual presentation of some of the work Yulia was doing during that week.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a sort of, it has the micro in the sense of, you know, here is what I was working on. And then, you know, the larger scale contextual stuff and also what we were recording in the studio that week.
So like a microcosmos thing.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds beautiful.
Yeah, it is. It's really beautiful. Yeah.
At the end, imagine somebody is going to hear all the concerts, all the performances in the Max Richter Reflektor. How would that person go home on Sunday night with an idea portrait of the artist in so and so many postcards or pictures?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, this program in a way is about questions rather than answers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that is what's so exciting about creative work. You know, creative works at their best point beyond themselves. You know, they sort of, a piece like Voices is about what's next,
mm-hmm.
right? It's about potential. It's about, here are questions, let's answer these questions, you know. That for me, and for example, someone like Pamela Zedd, you know, her work is all about that. You know, it's about exploring limits of language and meaning, and you know, this is what creativity can do. So I guess that person, if they sat through all of the music, they would come away with their head full of interesting questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm, you know, for me, that would be a good outcome.
lots of inspiration, lots of things to think and muse about.
Exactly. Yeah.
I find that with voice is also interesting, as you say that, because the sheer idea of putting that to music and having people read this out loud, you know, from all kinds of pieces from, is already such a prominent statement in itself. And also what Pamela Z does, you know, with some, you know, it alters the ordinary. Of course, that's what artists always has to do. But in a way, there are similarities. And then I so wonder, you know, Jason Moran is so far away from your piano style, for instance.
He certainly is.
Is it maybe just you're just envying him? Or why would you invite such a person? I mean, I'm happy you did.
Well, he's a, I mean, he's an absolute protean talent, isn't he?
It's a good term.
He really is. You know, he's got this sort of multidimensional, omnivorous musicality, which is, it's a thing to behold, you know. Exciting.
Will you be able to attend at least a certain portion of what you've invited?
Yeah, I'm trying to. My sort of calendar over the next few days is sort of minute by minute. But I want to try and hear as much as I can of everything, yeah, of course.
Yeah. So we're very much looking forward, Max, and thank you for having taken the time for
this. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie. Dieser Podcast wird vermarktet durch die Podcastbude.